On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Hillary Clinton was nominated at a convention marked by olive branches to Republicans queasy about Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders graciously endorsed her, but a lot of his delegates weren't ready to go along. Meanwhile, Trump said he hopes Russia releases the emails from Hillary's private server. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Margie O'Meara, a Democratic pollster and executive vice president at PSB Research. David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is our special guest. Welcome, everybody. So this was a convention. It was quite a convention. I was struck by how much conservative intellectuals liked parts of it. It's clear that Democrats' intention was to paint themselves as the party of American values under threat from Donald Trump. There was this sort of magnanimous choice led by the president to paint Trump not as an exemplar of Republican ideas, but as a traitor to them. The president said much of what he heard at the Republican convention didn't sound very Republican or conservative, a sentiment shared, if not by the Republican electorate, by a lot of people who write about conservatism for a living. But perhaps the most amazing moment of this convention was Khizr Khan, a Muslim immigrant and father of a U.S. Army captain killed in Iraq, who challenged Donald Trump about his attacks on Muslims.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
If you haven't seen that speech, I really suggest watching it. It's very powerful. At that moment, he pulls out a pocket constitution for Trump. In some ways, it looked like something you could have seen at a Republican convention in recent years, but obviously not at Donald Trump's convention. Rich, you tweeted about this convention, "They're trying to steal all our stuff, the city on a hill, American exceptionalism." Really, isn't it that Republicans yielded this stuff to Democrats this year?
They did. There was very little of it at the Republican convention. And I agree with you, Mr. Khan's speech was incredibly powerful, in part because rhetorically there's nothing quite like righteous indignation, especially when it's as well-earned as his. And his basic charges against Donald Trump at the end, the gut punches, are true. It's probably very likely that Donald Trump has never read the Constitution. And it's true that Donald Trump has never really sacrificed anything or anyone close to him. So the Democrats seem to successfully work this straddle where the substance was quite left, the furthest left we've seen in decades, and there was a successful effort to placate the Bernie Sanders supporters. At the same time, the affect, the pageantry, the rhetoric was very centrist and at times could be mistaken for a Republican convention. Gene Kirkpatrick, who famously assailed the San Francisco Democrats for blaming America First in 1984, wouldn't have recognized this convention.
Margie, do you think this convention worked, the attempts to appeal to the far left and the center at the same time? Do you think they pulled it off?
Well, that was certainly how it came across being there. You had all of the headliners were focused on the folks in the room who came from a variety of places on the left to the center, as well as folks watching at home, Republicans, and saying, come join us, you heard Secretary Clinton say. And Trump is such a good foil. I mean, there was really no topic that could be addressed at the convention that you couldn't push off of something that Trump had said, whether it was authoritarianism, whether it's not being patriotic or being too focused on oneself, or whether it's people with disabilities, or whether it's being warm and inclusive to people of other races and ethnicities or gender. There was really no topic where Trump has not said something that was so egregious that that Democrats could then talk about it and really show a real stark contrast. And I thought it was very effective.
One criticism I've seen of this convention was sort of that it was too sunny, too optimistic, not reflecting the mood of the country and not reflecting fears, often legitimate fears that people have, whether about terrorism or crime or anything else. And I'm wondering, because the convention was very powerful to me, but one thing this election has done to me is strip me of my confidence that I can accurately predict what American voters are going to want and going to like. Do you think that's a real concern, that this came off as out of touch with America because it was too optimistic about America?
I did hear that criticism, and I can see that. On the other hand, people do want to feel inspired. They do want to feel that things are going to be getting better, and that someone's really focused on bringing everyone together to make things better. And I think to that end, this convention was very successful.
This was a convention for America's winners, for upmarket America, for the beneficiaries of globalization, whether economic beneficiaries, people who've done well in the economic growth of the past half dozen years, or immigrants who have also benefited from a different kind of globalization. It writes off downmarket America. And that's something that's very easy to do. When I was at the Republican convention, this wasn't my brainwave. I stole the idea from Politico, but it did check out. I would ask any delegate I talked to, how is business for you personally? And the answer was unanimous. I mean, without exception, everyone said, it's great for me personally. And there they are in Cleveland. It's quite an expensive thing to go. If this race tightens, I think people will say two things about the Democratic convention. The first was the neglect of the concerns, the anxieties of downmarket America. There were a lot of programs for them, a lot of things that we will do for you, but very little of us talking to us. The losers of globalization were very much the audience for this convention, not participants. The second thing that I think that they're going to say is this point. What seems so clever now about the symbolic move to the center and the substantive move to the sharp left, that may not look so smart. President Obama, yes, gave Republicans permission to vote against Donald Trump. Maybe they don't feel they need permission. Maybe they feel what they need are some concessions, and they got none of those.
So the one pushback I'd give you on that, David, is that I feel like maybe this convention was writing off some of the concerns of downmarket white America. But when you look at the Democratic coalition and you try to talk about who's a winner and loser of globalization, or who has been hurt by the slow growth of wages, by persistently excessive unemployment over the last 7 or 8 years, these are things that disproportionately hurt African Americans, who yet seem to be as solidly as ever in the Democratic coalition, which makes me think that when people talk about these concerns of downscale America, they're not purely about economics. There seems to be, But I think people are saying, people are looking at what's happening now and saying, I'm upset about these changes because they're hurting my livelihood, they're hurting my wages. But really, that might not be what they're actually in their hearts so upset about.
But we always talk about this as if it would be a completely illegitimate thing for people who belong to what was once the majority group in a country to object to being turned into a minority group. Yet throughout history, we have seen majority groups of any kind do object to that. And you may feel it's impermissible for people to have these cultural concerns about displacement and replacement. But it's a democracy. They get to vote. And if they don't feel that those are legitimate concerns, then they're important concerns.
I want to pile in and agree with David. I think there are two weaknesses at the convention. One is this really lack of a bread and butter appeal to working class voters, which I thought was something that had just been left wide open for the Democrats, because the Republicans didn't talk about that at all, except for Trump some himself. And it was all sort of vague generalities and I'm your voice, kind of populist rhetoric. But there was no case he made really on policy. So I thought we'd see iron worker after single mom, after Teamster at the Democratic convention talking about how Democratic policies would actually make their lives better. And that wasn't there at all. Instead, we saw the patriotic pageantry and rhetoric, which I think was very effective. But I think this was one big vulnerability. It still leaves the Rust Belt path there for Donald Trump. And two, there was a hollowness at this convention in the form of Hillary Clinton, whose speech was, the writing was completely pedestrian, the delivery was pedestrian, and there is no way to make her an agent of change. And Bill Clinton tried his very best, but he was really making the case, look, she's been an agent of change since the 1970s, you know, reinforcing the point she has been at this and part of the system forever.
Yeah, I didn't think Hillary's speech was good either. But then, I thought Donald Trump's speech was horrifying, both in its content and delivery. And I thought it wouldn't connect with people in addition to horrifying me. And then the instant poll came out from CNN and showed that, you know, the viewers had liked it a great deal, although obviously people who watch convention speeches tend to be people who are aligned with the speakers. And then you saw the bounce that he got out of it. After Hillary's speech, we saw even more favorable reviews in CNN's instant poll than we had seen for Trump's speech. So my instinct was to agree with you, Rich. I thought the speech was flat. I thought it was uninspiring. It was a laundry list. It didn't. I thought other speakers at the convention made a much stronger argument for Hillary Clinton than she made herself. But I don't entirely trust my instincts to figure out whether that speech worked for people or not.
I thought she was a little looser than she often is, especially when she was talking about Trump. I felt like she had a little bit more humor and looseness and seemed a little bit more relaxed than you have seen her in that kind of large arena and that large stage. So I thought in that respect, she was stronger in her delivery than we've seen her at other places. And, you know, to the point of was enough mention made of folks from, you know, the middle class or the quote unquote Rust Belt. I mean, you had Joe Biden really make a very clear case talking about teachers and workers. You had Sherrod Brown, you had Xavier Becerra. I mean, there were quite, you know, there was quite a bit of that in some of the speeches for sure.
Hillary, she has a strong and authentic voice when she's attacking Donald Trump. I think that's when she's at her best rhetorically. Otherwise, it's completely average.
When I was watching the speech, I was like, the second half was much stronger than the first half, but that was in part because a great deal of the second half was devoted to attacking Donald Trump. And I think that, you know, these are two unpopular candidates facing off against each other. If Hillary wins, she's going to win on the back of voters who dislike both of them but dislike Donald Trump more. But I was just trying to think about it. Would it be possible to structure her speech so much just around how awful her opponent is? Even if that's her strongest argument, it feels like you have to try to make the case for yourself. And it's just weird to me that she can't make the case more effectively than I thought she did.
Well, there are two things if she'd wanted to do that, there are two ways to do that, each attacking a different part of the Republican coalition, and she chose neither. Way number one would be to steal some of Donald Trump's issues and try to then steal some of his working class voters. And that would have been making some comments about trade and migration. If you watch night one of the Democratic convention, the impression you would take is that Democrats don't believe there should be a border at all. Anybody who comes here, come on in, bring your family, bring your family's family. Everybody's welcome. It's hateful even to contemplate any kind of enforcement. And absolutely, if you get here, no matter how, you will never, ever be sent back, no matter how blatantly illegally you arrived. So she could have done that. Or the second thing is she could have addressed the upmarket part of the Republican coalition, the people who are going to vote for Hillary because they're frightened of Donald Trump. And the message for them is, don't worry, I will. This is the same message Richard Nixon gave to Democrats in 1972. I will not interpret a victory here as a mandate to go ahead with every crazy idea that every Democrat has ever had, from tax increases to, you know, federally funded daycare. But she didn't do that either. She said, yes, I will interpret this election as a mandate to go ahead with every crazy idea every Democrat has ever had. So both parts of the Republican coalition are on notice. Flags, yes. Patriotic speeches, yes. Any actual attempt to meet your concerns, no. You vote for Hillary Clinton, you get the whole shebang.
So, David, here's my challenge to you on that, is that I don't think Hillary is really substantively to the left of, say, Joe Biden or of Barack Obama. And I believe that if either of those people were on the ballot this year, they would be running several points better than Hillary Clinton has without any of those policy concessions that you described, purely because of trustworthiness and other personal characteristics. Do you disagree with that?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure that Barack Obama is to Hillary Clinton's left in important ways. I think that's true. He's rhetorically and methodologically more cautious than Hillary Clinton is, and he doesn't give off the sense. And look, this is what a lot of Democrats like about her, right? And what they don't like, about him, that she loves a fight. She's ready for a fight, whereas Obama is ready to lock you into a conference room and spend 6 hours talking about why, listening to you for one of them and then spending five of them explaining why he was right all along, and it would really be better for you to do what he says.
Well, let us know what you thought about the Democratic Convention at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Donald Trump's plea to the Russians. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC. Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Margie O'Mero, Democratic pollster and executive vice president at PSB Research. David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. So Donald Trump held a truly bizarre press conference on Wednesday in which he said he hoped Russia had the deleted emails from Hillary Clinton's private email server and three times urged the Russians to release them. He later said his call for foreign espionage against his political opponent was sarcastic. These comments were in response to an emerging consensus that the Russian government was behind the hack and leak of DNC servers, including emails from the DNC. I should note, in the interest of full disclosure, my fiancé is a consultant to the Democratic Party, and a substantial quantity of his emails were released. So the story's hitting a little close to home for me, but I'm trying my best to step back and look at it as objectively as I can. Rich, this seems like something that if a Democrat had said it about their Republican opponent that they wanted the Russians to come in and help, that Republicans would totally lose it. Isn't that right?
Oh, that's certainly true. I do think, though, that he was joking or trolling to some extent when he said that about the Russians should release her hacker emails and release them. But his blasé attitude toward what seems pretty clearly Russian intervention in a U.S. election is completely astonishing and appalling. And his attitude towards Russia in general, he's the most pro-Russian candidate we've had in decades and decades, and apparently doesn't mind that Russia gobbled up Crimea and, you know, is talking about potentially recognizing that annexation. And what he said on the cusp of his own acceptance speech, that he would have to kind of think about it and decide at the time if the Russians invade the Baltics, whether we're going to actually honor our NATO commitments, is dangerous. There's just no other word for it. Completely dangerous and irresponsible.
Margie, do you think voters care about this? And do you think there's a way to make them care about it? Because this is one of like a zillion things that feels like if a normal candidate had done it, we would be talking about it as a disaster crisis in their campaign. But for Trump, it was just Wednesday.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's to your point about losing your sense of what it would move voters. Although typically, foreign policy is not a top driver for most voters. They're more concerned about things that affect their daily life, and foreign policy for many doesn't fall into that bucket. That said, I've heard in focus groups, and I think in this particular election, it's quite possible that Trump's bad temperament or his ill-suited temperament for the job seems most important and most critical when it comes to foreign policy. And I've heard this in focus groups among Republicans, frankly, who say, look, I worry, even if, you know, I'm a Republican, maybe I agree with him on some things, but I just don't see how he has a conversation with a leader, or he has this finger on the button and he's going to do something crazy. He's going to get into a fight with somebody, or he's going to get into a Twitter fight with somebody. Then who knows what will happen? This is just another one of those examples, and it may be that this that foreign policy becomes more important here because he's seen as so incredibly unreliable.
Elections are multidimensional events, and so when you say, "Look, the iron worker in eastern Pennsylvania doesn't care about this," that's true. He doesn't, and so his vote won't be affected. But there are a lot of other people whose votes matter, too. There are a lot of people whose campaign contributions matter. There are a lot of Republican foreign policy types who are going to make make decisions about whether to validate Donald Trump or not. I don't think anybody has ever run for any party's nomination with less support from qualified past office holders in his or her party ever before in American history. Not even George McGovern. Even George McGovern did better than this. I mean, so these things matter. I want to anticipate something that some KCRW listeners may think, because there are smart people. This is not my view, but there are smart people who think, hey, I would endorse a softer approach to Russia. Maybe if we had a more conciliatory approach, we might gently guide them back into the community of nations from which they've strayed. As I said, not my view, but not a foolish thing to think. But Donald Trump is not doing that, because if you're going to have the conciliatory view of Russia, you have to show them where the lines are and show them the path forward at the same time. So you must say, invade Estonia? Absolutely not. Don't even think about it. About this or that other problem, we can talk. But Richard Nixon, who is the leading exponent in American history of a softer approach to Russia, always made clear, here are the lines and here is the avenue forward. Donald Trump has blurred the lines, and so there isn't really an avenue forward. All there is a terrible risk of miscalculation.
You know, can I say one other thing about that press conference? I didn't see it. I actually read it. And if you read Donald Trump, he is the most ill-disciplined and bizarrely on-message politician on the planet, because no matter how many outlandish statements there are in non sequiturs, every single answer has one of his four core messages. They all come back to trade, strength, immigration, and not letting our allies take advantage of us over and over and over again. It's like watching a car drive down an icy street and it veers wildly from one end of the street to one side of the street to the other, but it always gets down at the end of the block.
One other thing that alarms me about this, aside from the Russia issue itself, is that it seems like another part of the end of norms of reasonable disagreement in our political conversations. You know, normally elections are supposed to be trying to convince people to vote for you and not your opponent. They're not supposed to be about calling for foreign powers to intervene on your behalf, as they are not supposed to be about calling for your opponent to be locked up and put in prison. And while I think the Republican side has been worse on this, we've seen it also from the Democrats. We've seen reactions to Trump's comments by arguing that he's violated the Logan Act, which is a 1799 law that makes it illegal for private citizens to negotiate with foreign governments against U.S. interests. I'd note there's never been a successful prosecution under that law, and I don't expect Donald Trump to be the first person prosecuted under it. But Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri, brought that up, and that really struck me as Democrats responding in kind to Donald Trump, not just as a terrible candidate, but an illegal one. You saw a speaker from the stage of the DNC say that his comments reflected criminal intent, and it just further alarms me that this conversation is moving into the judicial realm in a way that it shouldn't.
But the partisans on each side, they always bring up the Logan Act. I forget what the specific instances were during the Bush administration, but Republicans were talking about it. Democrats talked about it when Tom Cotton wrote an open letter about Iran. So this is something, Logan Act only exists in the federal code to give partisans a talking point.
Well, you can't really compare that sort of talking point to what Trump says, which is so egregious. And here's the real tragedy here is that even if he loses, the fact that the entire world's being subjected to his to everything that he says, and to the potential that we may actually elect him as president, that he won the Republican primary, that he may win in November. I mean, that damage can't be undone, even if he loses by a substantial margin.
And Josh, with deference to your disclosure, I have to say, one of the things that is not getting enough discussion in all of this is the actual things that were revealed about what the DNC was doing were so unshocking to anybody who's ever had anything to do with a political campaign. You know, there's an email from somebody idly speculating whether it would hurt Bernie Sanders if people knew that he didn't believe in God. And
to be clear, Bernie Sanders says he's not an atheist.
But so there's somebody inside there saying, you know, Bernie's never denied being an atheist. Maybe we can use that. And people are shocked to discover that people inside political operations talk that way. And then they're shocked to discover that the DNC does not act like the Federal Election Commission and is not scrupulously impartial between candidates who've raised a lot of money for their fellow Democrats and candidates who became a Democrat last week. I thought the thing I was missing at this convention was I wanted to see Debbie Wasserman Schultz on the first day step forward and liken that scene in the Battle of Algiers with a French colonel defends French methods in Algiers. I apologize for nothing. We did what a party national committee should do. And if Reince Priebus had shown one half the gumption that I've shown, the Republicans would not be in this predicament today, because that would have been true.
I appreciate that, David, although I think it may give Debbie Wasserman Schultz a little bit too much credit. I think, okay, someone, you know,
okay, the actress who plays her in the movie when they release Game Change 3. She should do it.
In any case, I want to ask about something that Larry Summers has actually written over the last few weeks about Donald Trump and the need for what he calls a responsible nationalism. I think it goes to something you were saying, David, earlier, which is that, you know, these instincts that people have about America not being placed first and about wanting to focus on domestic national interests are not always unreasonable, and they will be asserted in politics, and you need to find responsible ways to address them. So I guess my question is, what can that look like? If Donald Trump is irresponsible nationalism, what would a responsible nationalism look like? What can we hope to see in the 2020 cycle that would be healthier than this?
My list of elements of responsible nationalism would, first, there would be a much more cautious approach to immigration and a much more cautious approach to immigration amnesty. Amnesty would not even be discussed until it was clear that enforcement was consistently working. That you would see, I want to preserve the World Free Trade System. I think Larry Summers would too, but we need to have more than this retraining assistance that we offer to the consistent losers. That's one of the ways that free trade with China has been different from trade shocks in the past with South Korea or Japan or Germany back in the day when Germany returned to real markets. It's just so big and so enduring a shock. I'm a foreign policy interventionist. That's my number one issue in is maintaining the U.S.-led global world order. But the administration in which I worked, the Bush administration, was too forward-leaning and was not successful, didn't deliver results. And so that is you're going to see a foreign policy that looks responsibly nationalist because it's concerned with maintaining a planet that works for everybody, but that doesn't talk so much about bringing the benefits of democracy to people who have not done absolutely everything to earn it for themselves.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Margie O'Meara, what's your rant?
So we did a poll recently after the Republican convention where we showed clips of four different speeches from Trump, Pence, Cruz, and Ivanka, and they were all impactful. I mean, all four of the clips showed a boost for the favorability of the speaker and a boost for Donald Trump. And there was actual movement over the course of the survey after people watched all four clips. And what this tells me is that as observers and as Democrats in particular, like myself, watching the convention feeling horrified. In fact, voters watching it saw something that they responded well to. What that's going to mean now when we do the same exercise after the Democratic convention, we'll see if there's a different type of bounce there. But I think it's a reminder that that voters are potentially looking for something that Trump has to say. It really reinforces the fact that it is a really divided electorate.
Rich Lowry.
I'm not a fan, obviously, of Hillary Clinton or her record, but I'd like to applaud one aspect of her record that was repeatedly highlighted at the Democratic convention. It was a complete disgrace that American schools once couldn't be bothered to teach disabled kids. So my hat's off to the parents and activists who bludgeoned lazy, thoughtless, and sometimes cruel bureaucrats and politicians into doing their duty, not to mention the decent and right thing.
David Frum.
Attention should be paid to what is happening in Turkey right now. In the wake of the military coup, which may or may not have been real, there is a counter coup proceeding that is leading to the extinction of all that remains of liberal freedoms in that hugely important NATO ally. Today is the day they are arresting not only journalists, which is appalling enough, but even more bizarrely, stock market analysts who are bringing forward news that the regime does not want to hear. I think Turkish democracy has been ailing for a long time. It is now near death's door.
For my rant, I just want to note we're about to enter August. August traditionally is the stupidest news month of the year because the fewest things happen and we need to find ways to fill the news time. Because of this election we are happening, I have no doubt that August will find its way to live up to that, even though we've already had an incredibly stupid year. I've written encouraging Hillary Clinton to challenge Donald Trump to a weekly debate every week between now and the election. I think this is the most important election of our lifetime, which I know is a cliche, but I think it's actually true. And a direct comparison of the candidates would be a useful thing for voters to have lots of exposure to between now and then. It would also fill up our August and give us something substantive to talk about instead of whatever nonsense I'm sure Donald Trump is about to put on our plates. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Margie O'Meara, and David Frum. Laura Dimillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced, distributed by KCRW.